Tonight on Arena, Brian McGilloway tackles the Troubles head on in his novel The Last Crossing, and musician Mira Nicali is with us ahead of her appearance at this year's Kilkenny Arts Festival. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Irish Chamber Orchestra will premiere Róisín Reimagined this week from St. Canice's Cathedral in Kilkenny as part of this year's Kilkenny Arts Festival. The project is a collaboration between the Irish Chamber Orchestra, Mira Nicali, and producer Donal O'Connor. The material is drawn from the Seannós tradition, works typically dating from the 16th to the 19th century, and Róisín Reimagined explores the connections between classical and traditional music and reimagines these timeless songs for a new era. Delighted to have Mira Nicali in the studio.
Nice to be here. How are you?
Not too bad at all. You were saying to me as you started, you'd be giving Kelly Harrington a run for her money at the moment. You feel as if you've been through the Olympics of a different kind.
Yeah, well, possibly that was the kind of running joke during the recording process, that it was the Seannós Olympics, but that I was the only Egypt that was running in the race, because it was full on, like the most intense thing I think I've ever done, probably apart from having my two babies. But just so fulfilling. Well, incredible.
Let's explain what the Seannós Olympics are. Róisín Dubh Reimagined, I suppose, even when we hear Róisín Dubh, and I mentioned this idea of the classical tradition and the Seannós tradition, Róisín Dubh, you're immediately going to think of Sean O'Rea.
Yeah.
Are you taking that? Was that some kind of a starting point for this project, or how did it inspire what you're doing here with these songs?
Well, I think definitely there are elements of that. I mean, that left such a lasting impression on all of us and on our tradition and moved it along in a different way, I think. But how this all began was during the pandemic, the very beginning, back in March. I was invited in to Sean O'Rourke's programme, and I was supposed to be promoting a tour, an upcoming tour I was about to do, and a new recording I had released. And of course, all that went out the window, and the interview went ahead. I didn't really know what to do or what to talk about, and I just thought I'd sing Róisín Dubh, unaccompanied, of course, because no band. Mm. And it was just, I suppose, the sentiment within the song. It speaks to the people of Ireland, and it says, Róisín na bíodh brón ort, you know, there are better days coming. And Róisín, of course, was a metaphor for Ireland.
Of course.
And yeah, it was just a kind of a serendipitous moment, because it seemed to react with people, it seemed to connect with them. You know, people know this music. It's in our psyche. It's in our DNA.
I referred to it in the Hauran Mhóra, the big songs, if you like. Now, Róisín Dubh is obviously one of those big songs. Are there actually a group of songs or a selection of Seannós songs that are referred to as in the Hauran Mhóra?
Well, I would say yes to that. I mean, all these things would be a matter of opinion. I mean, Seannós, what is Seannós? What is tradition? All very big, complicated questions. But for me, there are definitely Hauran Mhóra. And you know, after you've sung one,
that's why it's the Seannós Olympics.
Yeah. Well, I consider these songs to be really a form of high art, the classical music of Ireland, and they deserve to be up on a big stage. And I have such a huge love and respect for them. I'm just really thrilled to now finally get this opportunity. It is a dream come true.
Well, give us a sense of, obviously we've mentioned Róisín Dubh. What other songs are we talking about? What songs that people will know the minute they hear the titles of them?
Some of the songs that people will know, then there's An Chuaillín, which we might know as a slow air, but this is as a song with lyrics, and the original lyrics, of course, Molly St. George, which is one of the oldest harp melodies that we have, again with original lyrics. Bruach na Cardaí go Báine, one of the big monster love songs. Slán le Maig, written by one of our most famous classical poets, Andreas McCrae. Ar maidin mochas mair ma lapin bhuig. These are just songs that I think, even if you're not a fan or you know, someone who knows a whole lot about traditional music, the melodies will twig a memory, I think.
And the minute you mentioned several of those, the melodies start to come into my head. And what I hear are these long, slow, not always laments, but, you know, certainly a slow quality to them.
Yeah.
ornamentation where it's weaving in and around a note, and you're talking about big, long musical lines.
They're unreal, yeah.
Which demands a lot off the singer, I would guess.
Yeah, it's the most physically demanding amount of singing I've ever done, actually. But I wanted it to be like that. You know, I think after the year and a half we've all had, it was just like, there's no holding back anymore. You know, what are you waiting for? It could all end again tomorrow.
Yeah.
So it was just to take it, go for it head on, you know. I do adore these songs, and I suppose a part of me would have been afraid to touch them or to do something like this. Would I be able for it? Would people like it? Would it make sense? There, you know, there's so many things that maybe.
Well, look, let's have a little bit of a listen to the version that you've given us of Róisín Dubh. Now, we should explain that there are composers, stroke arrangers involved in
yes.
each of the big songs. So who was involved in the case of Róisín Dubh?
The whole premise behind this project is that we've taken 12 big songs and we've worked with the wonderful Irish Chamber Orchestra, who have just blown our minds with the welcome they gave us, and they poured their heart and soul musically into this as well. We have Paul Campbell, the conductor, and then along with the Kilkenny Arts Festival, we commissioned 6 Irish arrangers to arrange 2 songs each. And this particular song, Róisín Dubh, was arranged by our conductor, Paul Campbell.
Well,
and this is, you know, not fully there yet, but it's close enough to mixed.
Near enough to mixed.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'll hear the finer details. I bet you our listeners will think, what's she talking about? It's not close to there
yet.
Well, let's have a listen. On everybody by letting them hear the whole lot, because they'll have to tune in to hear the entire. That's an extraordinary arrangement of Róisín Dubh. Muireann na Gearlaigh with us in studio this evening. By the way, as you were speaking just before you went into that piece, Angela Flannery tweets to say, I could listen to Muireann na Gearlaigh talking all night, never mind singing.
Oh, God.
Such a voice. Yeah, and I think a lot of people would agree with her on that for sure.
Wow.
I was listening to the beginning of that version there, Muireann, and it starts out with the voice is so bare. Yes, you have the orchestra supporting you underneath, but it kind of is like it's providing in that opening section just a drone underneath what you're doing, which is a kind of support, but you also have to be the Olympian that can be up above that orchestra.
I felt so supported at all times by them, you know, and even in that subtlety, there's an immense amount going on. Mm. I learned so much to be standing there surrounded by them, watching what was happening. I knew so little about how orchestras work, and you heard the pipes there as well.
Yeah. Who was on the pipes,
so
did you
say? So that's Nick O'Brien. He's just an incredible piper and whistle player. And then we had Katrina Frost on percussion. You could hear that there as well. And Aisling Ennis on a beautiful golden concert harp, and Cormac McCarthy, another one of our composers, on piano, and Donal, our producer, Donal O'Connor, on harmonium and fiddle as well. So, you know, really amazing musicians to have.
Are they all as emotional as a Róisín Dubh? Because even listening to it, I could see that it was getting
like,
in you.
Yeah. I know, I'm just in bits. I've been crying for weeks, to be honest with you. Well, I've been crying for a year and a half, let's be honest, but like more lately. So it was very cathartic. I was afraid that for me it would be something that vocally was going to exhaust me, but actually I've come out of it and realised that more exhausting was just the emotional impact of these songs, you know.
Yeah.
And they're just powerful like that.
Give me a sense of, you've mentioned some of the musicians that are in there, some of the other arrangers that are in the mix. Because they're kind of, we'll know many of them as composers, but they've kind of composed and arranged. They're composing and arranging, I suppose, in some ways here.
So when you hear the way I'm singing that song, I mean, there's very little that I've done with the songs. I'm singing them pretty straight. You know, in fact, one of the songs, I'm singing it exactly as Sean Dehora sang it 50 or 60 years ago.
Which song is that now?
Ermadin Muchas Mair Malapan Vuig. That was composed by Maura Vuini Laoire. So that goes back to the 17th century. But it was arranged then for the Irish Chamber Orchestra by Sam Perkin, who is really an incredible contemporary composer from Cork. We also have Cormac, like I mentioned before, Cormac McCarthy. He would be, I suppose, from a sort of a jazz background with a keen understanding of the tradition, because his father, Johnny, is a traditional musician. We have Niavarian Barry, who would, I suppose, straddle both traditional and classical worlds. Linda Buckley, who I'm a huge fan of. Again, quite avant-garde, and she tackles Slán le Maig, which would be a song I'm, I suppose, quite known for singing. And she gave it such a different flavour and a different colour, but she really nailed the grief and the heartbreak in that song. And then we've Michael Keeney from Donegal, who provided some really lush, heartbreaking arrangements. More heartbreak for Bruch na Carrig a Boine and for An Chualann. And then Paul Campbell from Belfast, our conductor as well, who did Róisín Dubh and another song, Colleen an Uaire Domhain.
And you mentioned there particularly around Linda and Slán le Maig, which is a song, as you say, that people might know you from singing. How much did you rediscover these, given that the title of the project is Róisín Reimagined? Were you actually reimagining and rediscovering these songs, all 12 of them, in many ways?
Oh, absolutely. But like every time you sing these songs, you learn something new anyway. Even the smallest of Irish songs, there's always something each time you sing it around. Well, for me, there is anyway. But when someone comes along then and gives it their own interpretation, a new colour, a new flavour, you're digging down deeper again then, you know, and there's just a conversation happening between you, the orchestra, the arranger, and whoever composed these songs originally and what their story was.
Yeah, so. And you've already, it's all done now at this stage. In fact, you've all the filming done. So it's been shown tomorrow night. Is it all finished at this stage?
So yeah, it's recorded both for audio. We're going to release it as a vinyl and a CD and a download. We're going to stream it as part of the wonderful Kilkenny Arts Festival, and I have to say a huge thank you to them for being so supportive, and especially Olga Barry, who believed in this from the very, very beginning. So it'll be available online from the kilkennyarts.ie website from Friday, August the 13th until I believe Sunday, and we really, really want to go out on the road with this. You know, that's the dream.
I would love to see it in a live situation as well, and see you doing the Olympics on a stage in
could
front
I just,
of me.
As well, could I please thank everyone who donated to the Kickstarter to help us get this over the line to record it, and also Fearrs na Gaeilge and the Irish Chamber Orchestra. It's so hard to make music right now, you know yourself. So to support the arts and
We're in the Cowley on Shin, and Róisín Reimagined will be available, as Muireann said, online from Friday the 13th, a limited period as part of the Kilkenny Arts Festival. Full details on kilkennyarts.ie. Taking place every July, the Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival in Harrogate is an annual highlight for crime fiction year fans and authors alike. Last month, in addition to selecting Chris Whittaker's We Begin at the End as Crime Novel of the Year, the festival broke with tradition and singled out a second novel for special recognition. That novel was Brian McGilloway's The Last Crossing. Brian, best known for his Inspector Ben Devlin novels set in the borderland of Donegal and the author's native county of Derry, and for his more recent series featuring D.S. Lucy Black, a public protection officer in the PSNI. The Last Crossing is Brian's first standalone novel, the tale of a 30-year-old murder in Scotland and of those responsible for it, Northerners Tony Cannon, Carolyn Logue and Hugh Duggan. Delighted to have Brian McGilloway join me on the line this evening. And I'll come back to the three, Tony, Karen and Hugh, in a minute. But The Last Crossing was almost the novel that disappeared because of COVID, in fact, Brian.
It was, and thank you for having me this evening. It came out at the very start of the lockdown last year. And it was a small independent press that published it. It came out the first week in April. All the bookshops had closed. Everything had shut down. And it just vanished. Without trace, and even in terms of kind of the PR and stuff for it, obviously the news was totally taken over with COVID, completely understandably. So by kind of October of last year, we'd almost kind of written the book off as it just it just didn't quite get its chance. So I was really lucky then that Constable, who are publishing all of the Devlin and the Lucy Black books, then agreed to publish it in paperback. And it kind of got a bit of a second life then. Now, it still came out in the middle of this year's lockdown, but thankfully the Theakston's Award kind of just gave it a wee bit more.
Yeah, it gives it a little bit
more oxygen.
Yeah, a little bit more of a push. And I suppose in some ways, I think even in its initial stages, Brian, it was hard enough to get someone to take this novel on board, I would guess. Because while your novels are set, the Ben Devlins and the Lucy Blacks, yeah, we're in and around the borderlands in both of them. And there are touches of the Northern Irish story in both of them. But really, this one, The Last Crossing, it hits the Troubles head on in a way I don't think you have done before.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I deliberately set out with the Devlin books to write non-Troubles crime stories set around the border region. And as you say, in each of them, there's kind of the shadow of it, certainly, or the echo of it is there. Because it would be inaccurate for that not to be to be there, I suppose. But with this one, it was a story that I had in my head for quite a while, and had wanted to write it, and had kind of reached. I'd written the fourth of the Lucy Black books, and Devlin had stopped speaking to me for a while. But it had been quite a while since I'd done a Devlin, and I had this story in my head. I was out of contract, and I thought, right, I'm going to write this now when there's no kind of imperative on me to write anything else.
Apart from the contractual side of things, though, was there something artistically or even something politically or happening in the world at the time that made this story kind of rise to the top of your writing desk, if you like?
No, it really was just, it was a story that had been there. I had tried writing it in different ways. I mean, I had first discussed it with a TV company with an idea doing it as a screenplay. And the response that I had got was, look, people really don't want to touch Northern Ireland's Troubles stories. And there was a similar feeling, I suppose, even in terms of the publishing side of it. And so I had tried it in different ways. I tried doing it as a short story. I had tried doing it as a screenplay. I actually started writing in a stage play at one stage, and it just wouldn't work for me. And one of the techniques that I use in the book is a thing called concatenation, where the last word or phrase of one chapter becomes the opening word or phrase of the next. And it was something, again, that I had been trying to do for a while. I had actually used it in Little Girl Lost. The very first draft of Little Girl Lost had two alternating narratives and concatenated between them. And I got about three quarters of the way through the book and just had a brick wall. Couldn't work out what was wrong with it, and eventually realized it was a second narrative. So I just removed the entire second narrative.
That became a different book. But in the case of The Last Crossing, this concatenation, as you call it, you know, the last word picking up, being picked up as the first word in the next chapter. What's also interesting is you are jumping time frames in the process of doing that. So let's get a sense of what's happening in both time frames. We start in Glasgow 30 years ago, and we start with a pretty horrendous crime.
Yeah, and again, I suppose a lot of like my books tend to be more police procedurals, so there's always a whodunit element. With this, I had no interest in whodunit. You know who did it because they do it on the opening page. What I was really interested in with this book was exploring the consequences of violence, not on the victims or their families or the police, but on the people who actually carry out the acts of violence. And so what the book does is, it alternates between kind of 30 years ago when these three people kill a fourth person in their group. And then 30 years later, they make a return journey to try to remember where the body was buried so that it could be returned to the victim's family. And what I was really interested in was, how did what happened in the past reflect on the present, and how did each of those characters reconcile themselves to what they had done. And so the three of them have all responded in different ways to that initial act of violence. One of them has compartmentalized it and just has kind of gone on with their life and pretended it didn't happen. One of them is totally unapologetic about it and kind of angry in a way that he's being forced to have to go back as if it's almost revising the past. And then the central character of Tony just feels that his entire life has been blighted by it and has been looking for something without realizing that it's kind of forgiveness that he needs. So the present day scenes begin in a confessional. And the novel becomes, in some ways, his kind of pilgrim's progress towards finally understanding.
Tony is the narrator of the novel. Tony, Karen, and Hugh Duggan, all three of them involved in this murder back 30 years ago. Tony now is a sacristan. He was a teacher. He's now a sacristan.
Yeah.
And has he found God, do you think, in the process of it, or has God helped him to deal with it? Because he has had a tough time. His wife is very ill. They lost a child, a stillborn child. So he believes lots of this is kind of karma coming back on him.
Yeah, I mean, and there's an element of tragedy about it. I mean, there's kind of elements of Greek and Roman tragedy weaved into it. And part of it is that he feels he has a kind of a doom in his blood, that this thing that he did, this breach in nature that he caused, everything that has happened since then is a consequence of it. And I suppose the book is about his movement towards self-knowledge and the kind of the search for meaning in religion and meaning in all the other things that he has looked for have all been they've all been attempts for him to reach that point of self-realization. And in actual fact, he can only do it by going back to the woods where they buried him and facing up to what he did.
Yeah, and Karen is the character who has basically compartmentalized things in some way. She's kind of got on with her life and said, that was then, this is now. And Hugh Duggan is the guy, I suppose, who politically back 30 years ago was perhaps most motivated, or the most the person who was involved in the cause, if we want to put it that way. He was the one who was in that situation 30 years ago. Now, post-peace process, he's in a very different world. How happy is he with the world that he's now in?
Yeah, I mean, certainly he is presented, and he kind of, as a character, comes across as someone who feels that they've been used. And that they did what they did, believing that it was the right thing to do. And now kind of the view of that, the narrative has been changed against his wishes.
I was going to say a very interesting character in the process of what Hugh has to kind of go through and work out for himself between what was back 30 years ago and what's happening now is the character of Richard Barr, a young guy, post-peace process, has no concept of anything that went on beforehand, or at least has a very different picture of it maybe than those who were involved. How important is that perspective in terms of what you wanted to look at in how the Troubles are actually handled politically in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he was kind of one of the most important characters in a strange way. And initially, he seems to play quite a minor role. But what really interested me, I remember seeing a few times kind of news reports from the North focusing on the younger generation and how they feel about things. And these are people that didn't live through it, people that were born after the Good Friday Agreement. And who are still carrying the kind of the pain and the anger and the resentment of earlier generations. Mm. And I kind of wanted to understand even that. Why would that happen? Why, if you hadn't been alive during it, how would you respond to that? Would it become kind of mythological almost, or legendary, or would you want to move away from it? And so he was quite an interesting character to kind of develop. And I spoke to some of the kids that I had taught, kind of past pupils, and asked them about their views and why would people feel this way. And he kind of became, I suppose, an amalgamation of those conversations.
The other thing is, I mean, I presume, given that we're talking about this trio of characters, Tony, the narrator of the book, Karen, the woman who seems to have put it all to bed, if you like, and Hugh Duggan, the guy who was very politically motivated back in the day and now finds himself in a world that he just can't recognise, and it seems to, he feels as if he's been used. The three of them are going to uncover this grave. The disappeared and the stories that we've had around the disappeared in recent years must have fed into the writing of the book in some way.
Oh, it did, absolutely. And I had one of the earlier Devlin books, The Nameless Dead, had looked at that idea of the disappeared from the perspective of the fact that no forensic evidence could be taken and no examination could be done and there'd be no prosecutions. This one kind of came more from that idea of the people who had to go back to try to remember where it was, and even that idea about memory and how, I suppose, unreliable memory is, and how slippy it is, and how each of them remember key incidents slightly differently. And what the book tries to do, even structurally, there's those alternating chapters between past and present, and then as the book moves towards the end, at times in the present, Tony's memories almost are laying themselves over the present day the very last chapter.
One final question on the book, Brian. Now, it would have been well written at this point in time, at the recent statement from the British Prime Minister around the investigation of past events and potential amnesties, but it really is the subject in lots of ways of what you're writing about in the book. What was your reaction to that statement from the British Prime Minister?
It sounded like another soundbite up there with get Brexit done and get COVID beat. Now it's we're drawing a line under the Troubles. I think it just shows a total lack of understanding and a lack of empathy for the families of victims who still need those stories to be told. That's kind of the point. People, at wakes, we have wakes so that we can talk about the dead and we can tell the stories and share those stories. That is culturally how we deal with our grief. And to kind of say, right, that's it, no more. We're drawing a line under it. We don't want to hear any more about it. It's totally out of tune with the reality of how people grieve and how people need to be allowed to grieve. And somebody telling you, right, we're drawing a line under your grief, doesn't make it stop.
Brian, thanks for speaking with us this evening. That's Brian McGilliway, and congratulations on the mention in the Theakston Prize. The Last Crossing is a novel that Brian McGilliway has been speaking to us about, and it is published by Constable. And staying with the theme of remembering the past, as we go through the centenary of the revolutionary period in Irish history, it becomes more apparent just how important the poet W.B. Yeats was when he wrote and pondered about these events as they happened and brought their complexity and the horror of our ancestors' actions to a contemporary audience. Marrying the words of Yeats with contemporary images is a project undertaken by the Hamilton Gallery in Sligo. It began in 2015, and now in terms of the centenary, they're looking at that most awful and difficult of periods, the Civil War, which we were on the brink of 100 years ago. Joining me this evening is Martina Hamilton of the Hamilton Gallery in Sligo to talk about their current exhibition, Meditations in Time of Civil War, which of course references the Yeats poem. Martina, this is the gallery's seventh invited artist exhibition, where thematically you've taken a major poem of W.B. Yeats set against the decade of commemorations, different ones at different times. Just give us a sense of what you were doing in the overall project, first of all.
Yes, originally this was an idea that was dreamed up to be part of the 150th anniversary of Yeats's birth in 2015. And it was through a conversation with Susan O'Keefe, who's now director of the Yeats Society in Sligo, that we began this idea of giving the opportunity for artists to respond to a different poem each year. And we've covered a lot of ground since then, not always choosing the particular anniversary of the poem. But yes, in this case, we're 100 years on from the Civil War.
Yeah, and in the case of Meditations in Time of Civil War, we're talking about quite a complex and perhaps not one of the better known of Yeats's poems. You asked the authors, or the artists, to respond directly to the poem. Was that the brief, as it were?
Yeah, it's a very open brief. It's very generous, and the idea is to allow artists to find their own way in. In some cases, it can be a subject matter that they find in the poem that mirrors or reflects something that they're already exploring. In other cases, it can be a personal story where they link, for whatever family reasons, to or to their own life story in some way to the poem or to an image. Mm. Whether it's a peacock or the tower or an image that's in the poem that they personally respond to that. So it's very varied. And in this case, we have 125 artists, and each of them is given the opportunity to make a painting that's 30 centimetres square. And then when it comes to presenting the exhibition, we show it in a very fair-handed way. We present it alphabetically.
And you have, they're in panels. So each of the 30 by 30 paintings, they're in panels then. It's 24 in each panel.
Well, it's an approximate device to show the work. And as we found on occasion when we have brought the exhibition to other venues, we have actually shown it in a linear way. Yeah. So, you know, it's something that can, depending on the space, it can be presented in different ways. But it's a very fair way. All the individual personalities get to shine within this concept.
How would you describe the poem itself then, Martina, in terms of what you think overall Yeats is doing across? Quite a long poem in seven different sections, it is.
It's a long and it's a difficult poem, and I certainly wouldn't feel that I'm a Yeatsian scholar or an academic or historian. But as a layperson looking in at the poem, as a lot of the visual artists would have done, it's a very difficult. I mean, we're killing ourselves as a nation, and Yeats using his beautiful language to portray little details that conjure up emotion. Whether it's cracks in the pavement and insects dwelling there, or whether it's the tower itself.
Yeah, because he was living in Tir Ballyli at this time.
That's right. And the poem has seven stanzas: ancestral houses, my house, the table, my descendants, the road at my door, and the snare's nest by the window. So it's a poem that has a lot of different themes within it.
Well, let's have a look at some of the specific images and how the artists have responded to something within the Yeats text. We'll start with Pádraig Rini's painting or work, which is called "The Road at My Door," referencing section 5 of the poem itself, which starts with "The Road at My Door." An affable irregular, a heavily built Falstaffian man comes cracking jokes of civil war as though to die by gunshot were the finest play under the sun. And there is a kind of an affability in Pádraig's picture which belies the what was going on at the time. Just describe the image to us, if you would, Martina.
Well, I mean, they are these fresh young faces looking out at you. And, you know, as though they were doing a selfie or something, they're coming out from the newly established Irish state, sepia tones of fire in the background. And, you know, it has a nightmarish and surreal, threatening quality. Pádraig himself really was inspired by his own, you know, family stories from his grandfather. So there would be a very direct link for him to that time of civil war. So, you know, it's a personal painting for this particular artist.
And do you know that the people who are represented in the painting itself, are any of these perhaps Pádraig? You mentioned his grandfather there. Are they specific people, or are these imagined characters?
I imagine that he has used a collage of images from his own personal family albums. So I feel that certainly there's a sense of it. At the same time, when you look in at it, as though it could be anybody's boy next door of the time. And so it draws you in that way, that young people in uniform, you know, here we are, you know, this is the raw face of war.
Then moving on to Sarah Quick's image. And by the way, as I say, we'll tweet these images as we're going along. At RTE Arena is the Twitter page, and you can follow what we're doing there. So we've had Porrick's, The Road at My Door. Let's move on to another image by Sarah Quick. And this is an image called I Must Nourish Dreams, again, referring to the poem, the Yeats poem itself. This isn't a direct comment, I suppose, on the Civil War. It's one of those things where you were saying, Martina, how some of the artists have, I suppose, responded in terms of their own contemporary life, their own life today.
Yeah, I mean, just before the lockdown, Sarah had just had a new baby. And so she had spent that time in isolation, I suppose, watching her little boy growing up his entire life in isolation, not knowing what his future would be. And, you know, the line in it, I must nourish dreams, seems particularly poignant for him. But the child has got that capacity to conjure up this sort of, you know, the bold face of a child. They're full
just
of
maybe
anger.
Again, you would describe the image of the child that we see for us, Martina.
Well, it's a really fleshy, soft face, beautiful baby boy who's staring intently, trying to figure something out. And it's just that, you know, that the way a mind of a baby can be so intense and yet so soft and vulnerable.
And as you say, that idea that Sarah has picked up on, that, you know, you nourish the dreams that are going on in the head. And because of that title, you start imagining, what is he thinking about? What is this child thinking about? What are his dreams? What is he dreaming of?
Absolutely.
Let's move on then to a third image, which is called The Stair's Nest. And this refers to the sixth stanza of the poem, The Stair's Nest by my window, the bees built in the crevices of loosening masonry. And this is exactly what Orla Debris has given us, a representation of that wall that Yeats is talking about. Describe the image once again for us.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose Orla is working in bronze, so she can give the three-dimensional feel of what the intense busyness of animals buzzing around in the cracks in the surface. She's an artist who's contributed every year since we started this process, and very generously, this piece, I think, conjures up an emotional sense as well as it being a very literal interpretation.
I'll finish up with another of the images that you sent in to us, Martina. This is Graham Gingles, and We Had Fed the Heart on Fantasies. This is interesting in that I suppose in some ways Graham is maybe critiquing the poem rather than reacting to it in a positive way, if that's the right way to put it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if he's a huge fan of Yeats poetry, and I doubt that everyone that takes part in the exhibition is. But the curious thing about being given this challenge, or somebody throwing down the gauntlet, is you find your way in, whether it's through history or whether it's through the images, or whether it's through the poetry and the resonance in that you might find. But in Graham's case, I think that, you know, he was very disturbed by the atrocities on all sides, in both the War of Independence and Civil War. I'm afraid the reality of Irish history bears little relationship to the romantic notion of Ireland, was his comment. This is a land of extreme cruelty and steeped in blood. In this time of war, only flies thrive. And he has literally used the bodies of flies in little compartments within the image. He's a symbol there also of, I think it's of the tower. And then he has this beautifully rendered line drawing of Yeats. So it's a very an interesting and different approach to the subject matter.
Well, I suppose when you've got 125 artists, you don't want them all to take the same approach. So absolutely not. Yeah. Okay. Well, listen. Thanks for sharing some of the images from the exhibition with us. That's Martina Hamilton of the Hamilton Gallery. Meditations in Time of Civil War runs at the Hamilton Gallery, and you can find out full details hamiltongallery.ie. Part of the Tread Softly Festival, and you can find out details about that festival and everything happening there. on treadsoftly.ie. Stevie Granger, or Stevie G to you and me, is the face of Cork's music scene, intricately tied with beats, bars and community. And over the past two decades plus, he has worn all the hats. He's been a producer, a DJ, a promoter, a youth worker specialising in helping Cork's migrant communities, and a long-running host on radio, both pirate and commercial. At the end of this month, August the 28th, in fact, he's hosting Stevie G Presents, which will take place in the beautiful surrounds of Cork's Fitzgerald Park. The gig is part of the Magic Nights by the Lee, a series of gigs taking place around Cork City from August the 20th through until September the 4th. Stevie G joining me from Cork to tell me more. You're kind of in by the skin of your teeth on the Magic Nights aspect of things here, Stevie, because in fact we could call your thing Magic Afternoons. It's a little bit earlier in the day, in fact.
Yeah, we're going for late afternoon. Yeah, thanks for having me on. We've got the gigs are promoted by the Good Room with the Cork City Council, the local live performance program here, and it's great that we're kind of my presentation of acts really are more kind of they wouldn't be as well known as the John Spillane and Frank Walters who make up the rest of the bill. So we're early afternoon, but kind of evening, I guess.
Yeah. And when you went about choosing those that you wanted to highlight here, was there a particular set of criteria that you were using, Stevie?
Yeah, it's just all acts that are breaking through in Cork at the moment. I mean, it's amazing the talent of the young people in Ireland at the moment. Lots of acts haven't even played live because there's 20-year-olds out there who were kind of just barely 18 when the pandemic started. Most of these acts haven't performed that much. Some of them have been around for a few years. Some of them are just literally emerging during the last sort of 18 months. But the kind of criteria really was breaking acts that I'm playing on the radio. There's a big kind of diverse background. You mentioned that I do work with the migrant community. So I'd say half of the acts, they're all Cork-based. Yeah. We have Megan Murray, all right, she got in and the kind of grandparent rule, so we kind of did a we did a Tony Cascarino on her because she's living up in Dublin at the moment, but she did study here, and some of the other girls are coming from an African Irish background. It's all girls actually, except Sam Healy.
Well, tell me a bit about Sam Healy, and we listen to a bit of Sam, and then we'll be fair and represent the others as well. So Sam Healy, who is he?
Okay, he's a youngster from Cork. He's only 16. He's a multi-talented musician. He plays sax on a big track out at the moment, which is featuring heavy on my show by Dick Carter. But he's also a solo artist. He's a singer, songwriter, producer. He's only 16, as I say. And I think we might be playing a little track from him in a minute called Cherry Cola.
Yeah, a very laid-back guitar style he has. He's the guitarist here, I'm presuming, as well, Stevie, yeah?
Yeah, he's doing it all, and he's going to have a little band on the day, but he's absolutely excellent. And as I say, he's just 16, and the potential is incredible.
Wipe your bloody nose, I don't want to see that. And I don't care who knows, just leave me out of it. Reminisce on days of old when you weren't always out of it.
That's a little flavour of Cherry Cola from Sam Healy. And Sam, one of the artists performing as part of Stevie G Presents Magic Nights by the Lee. And really, Stevie G, you couldn't get more kind of nighttime balmy feel than that track. It really is very laid back, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, we're going to be doing the shows in the parks as well. I think it's very important. We've got amazing parks down here and all over the country, and it's great to see them used. I mean, there's a bandstand there that's sitting there. I used to run shows there years ago, but it's kind of underutilized really. And I think obviously the last 18 months, particularly recently, we've all kind of realized that we need more creative thinking when it comes to putting on daytime shows as well as nighttime ones.
Tell me a little bit about the track, because while Sam's track there is, as I say, very laid back and certainly has very little sense of any sense of urgency about it, it's a relaxed feel to it. In the case of the track Make Me Feel, which features Danny G, King Coco and Minnie Marley, we're talking about a direct comment here really on the state of things at the moment, aren't we?
Yeah, King Coco is a rapper. She's a singer as well. I'm working with her here in Cork. She's from Nigerian descent. Very exciting. There's lots of women have taken over the rap world in the last few years, and King Coco will be one of Cork's representatives. Obviously, in Ireland, we've got Denise Chyla and many more. And she's guesting here on a track by Danny Groland, a friend of mine from Dublin. And he's got another another female rapper, Ophelia, who's based down in Cork. She's another dub who does loads of work with the kids down here as well. But King Coco's verse, yeah, it's directly commenting. I think this song was made last year in lockdown.
2020, everything kind of scary. Coronavirus got people buried. Threat to World War III, RIP, Kobe. Mad earthquake stepping in Turkey. But I'm just doing me, trying to better myself. Busy getting money, getting racks in my shelf. Mama told me to forget her, told me not to sweat her. Haters stay cheesy, might call them cheddar. Look me, I ain't no basic chick. My bar's complex like arithmetic. Believe me when I say get a walking stick. Cause my haters stumble when I speak legit. Bring the sauce, girl, stay dry. My work is fire.
There we go. Rapper King Coco as part of that track, Make Me Feel, again part of Stevie G's Presents Magic Nights by the Lee. She's some rapper on the basis of that verse at any rate, Stevie.
Oh, she's unbelievable. Actually, she performed at that very stage when I first met her at Africa Day about 5 years ago. She was a singer still in school, but now she's making her way more of a rapper. But I think the interesting thing as well, when it comes to women behind the mic and lots of young people behind the mic, especially in Ireland, but anywhere around the world, it's just trying to give young people a voice. And music obviously is a great way of expression. And yeah, she's got great attitude and you can hear it there.
You worked with people in direct provision and you'd mentioned some of your work with various migrant groups in Cork. To what extent do you think music has provided an outlet for people in those type of situations to really express their identity?
Absolutely. I mean, anything across the arts. We did a lot of work with the Glucksmann Gallery here. Now they've done some brilliant projects across the arts, multidisciplined, really. But it's just trying to give people a voice. And you can see at the moment, there's some emerging artists. There's Alicia Ray, who came from Direct Provision herself. She actually lives up in Dublin. She's a rapper and a singer. Tolu McKay, loads of other artists have experience in these realms. And it's just important to listen to these voices. I mean, it can be you and me talking about Direct Provision all day, but the voices who've gone through it, and not necessarily as well for the artist to be just expressing about Direct Provision, just expressing their own background, their own lifestyle. And as I always say to all of the kids we work with, no matter where they are, lots of them have a richer kind of cultural background than many of us who just lived in one country. Lots of them can speak multiple languages. They've got all sorts of different cultural heritage that mightn't be as one-dimensional as some. So yeah, just trying to get them to use it in their tracks. But it's all on them, really, and it's listening to their voices, which I think is important, because we can talk about it forever, but these are the voices that matter.
What about numbers that you can get into this? Everything, I presume, will have to be socially distanced, even though we're outside. Will there be limits on the numbers that you can have?
Absolutely. This is limited to 200, and obviously the tickets just went straight away. They're free gigs, so obviously that's massively limited. It's a little bit frustrating, but we'll take what we can get at the moment. I've had shows in that park with a few thousand, but those days will be back, I'm sure. And we're obviously a little bit frustrated that the roadmap for the music industry isn't as clarified, or it's not really, it's not there at the moment, but hopefully that'll change in the next couple of weeks.
I doubt that'll mean that you won't be cheering Cork, however, when it comes to the hurling, I'm presuming.
Absolutely. I won't be one of the 40,000 who are invited up to that one, but we're all going to be there in spirit, and we hope we can, because it's been a while, you know.
It certainly has. Right. Listen, I can only finish up with one now, and I have two left. So I let you choose which you want to hear. Do you want to hear Blackheart or do you want to hear Jenna Keating?
Oh, God, I hope they're not both listening to this. Put on Blackheart. She's a producer. She's an engineer. She writes everything. She records everything. She's amazing. They're both amazing. They're all amazing. So put on Blackheart. Emer O'Sullivan is her real name, and she's very exciting as well. Thanks a million.
Not at all. Thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Stevie G, and here's a little bit of From a Dream from Blackheart.
Lies a beauty queen who's candy heart. Get up.
And that's From a Dream from Blackheart. Magic Nights by the Lee, series of seven free live outdoor shows across Cork City featuring John Spillane, Lorraine Nash, the Franklin Waters, Candy Warhol, Stevie G and more. Locations across Cork including Fitzgerald's Park, the Glen Park, Ballinlough Park, Ballincollig Regional Park, and all happening between August the 20th and September the 4th. Tickets are free, but you'll need to check. They might be sold or all gone at this stage, but sure, check out the website magicnightsbythelee.com, which brings us to the end of Monday night's programme. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I will talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock once again, here on RT Radio 1.